Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Wednesday, May 3rd, Carrboro 2006 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting. We have a lengthy agenda tonight, so we'll get right to it.
Before we get started, can I make an announcement?
I guess we won't get right to it.
We usually don't meet on Wednesday nights.
Yes.
And this particular Wednesday night, one of our board members is making a particular sacrifice because it is Randy's birthday, and she's here on her birthday. So I'd like everybody to give Randy a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, right. I'm legal now.
All right, happy birthday.
So you mean when you run, do you run underage?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. We have a couple of people signed up to speak on matters that are not on the agenda, would like to start by recognizing Wes Hare. If you would come up to the podium, please.
Be up at the podium, right?
So the folks at home can hear you.
Mr. Mayor, members of the board, my name is Wes Hare. I'm co-chair. I'm here as co-chair of the Orange County Peace Coalition. First of all, I want to thank you all for your energy, wisdom, and courage in passing the impeachment resolutions. And all of them are equally important, I think. Second thing is, if you ever want to annex a small section of the end of Flemington Road, I'd be glad for you to do that, because you all are taking over Chapel Hill's former energy. The Orange County Peace Coalition needs your help on Memorial Day. I have just found out, as we started to put together the third Memorial Day commemoration that we've had, that there's a $2 million insurance policy. And I'm not arguing about that policy, but we don't have that kind of money to cover that. I really don't know how much it costs.
Just $2 million.
What I'd like to suggest is maybe you can adopt this. Can you all make a resolution and have this be part of your event so that we don't have to pay this? Or if you'd rather give us the money to buy the insurance, that's fine too, but we just need your help. I don't know what we can do with it.
Mr. Manager, can you clarify? I thought that the portion that you have done with us for several years was a part of our official Memorial Day activities. Am I incorrect in that? In which case, an insurance policy would not be required.
I'm not aware that it's been a part of the town of Carrboro. Anita may know something different.
Mark.
Yes.
We are an activist community, and we're proud of our tradition of activism. And it's who Carrboro is. And I don't care whether it's activists from the right who are welcome to march here and have events here, or from the mainstream progressive group. Well, they are. Every time an activist group wants to have an event in an activist community, we go through this. We have got to come up with a way of resolving this, because on one hand we say all are welcome, we're a community that prides itself on speaking out, and then on the other hand, whenever a group comes and wants to do something that's activist-oriented, we have this problem. And it's nobody's fault, it's a system problem. But it's a system problem that I'd like to see us resolve.
Hi, Joel.
Hello.
Could I just respond quickly?
Sure.
And to say that staff is working on a report to bring back to the board on June 13th, trying to look at events that have occurred in the past, the types of events, and trying to provide some categories for you to look at, and perhaps some ranges of things where perhaps some events there might not be a need for insurance, others we might suggest there would be some range of insurance requirements, so that hopefully at some point there won't be a situation where every group that has an event feels the need to come here and have the board make policy sort of on the fly.
Right.
Do we know what that $2 million policy costs the groups need?
I don't know exactly. I mean, it's, you know, I'm sure different insurance companies charge different prices, and they're different kinds. If, for example, if it's an organization that has a lot of functions, it probably makes sense for them to look at a general liability policy that would be an annual renewal kind of a policy. If it's somebody that only does one or two events a year, there's something called a special events liability policy that would be for a particular day and based on an estimated number of participants. And that would generally be cheaper than a year-round
policy.
But
it hasn't come up before that we've heard what that figure is.
I don't know what EarthFest paid for, and they got the $2 million policy for last weekend.
Mark?
Yes, ma'am.
Nobody has brought this up, and nobody's brought this up to me. But I'm concerned that it's a free speech issue, that if people come before us and they want to have a activist event, and we say, yeah, you can do it, but no, you can't do it unless you have this money, I could be wrong in looking at it that way, but I think it could be construed to be that.
Well, I'm coming on the tail end. The only thing I would say is it would be a free speech matter if we looked at the content of what they said, and we expect you to pay more because of the content. If it is reasonably related to the cost of providing services, then I don't think we are in a free speech issue. If it is one of monetary cost and we keep some nonprofits out or, for want of a better word, groups that are not incorporated, association groups of people, then that is a economic issue. So I'm not, unless we said, for example, that if you, whatever you're saying, I don't like cats group that's going to rally, and you say, well, I like cats, so we're going to charge you $10,000, but if there's the I don't like dogs rally, we're going to charge them $1,000, and that's a problem. But if everybody is treated equally, the issue is the cost of the insurance.
degree out of work for some.
Steve, you may have addressed this point, but so is there some type of report coming to us on this topic?
On June 13th.
On June 13th, somewhat
can
after,
I just make
somewhat
sure
after Memorial Day.
We have just several weeks to put this together, and every month, for the last 2 years, your mayor, and I think you're working on a proclamation, Mr. Mayor, also.
Yes, sir.
Your mayor has issued a proclamation, which is why I thought possibly the way of dealing with it would be to see if you could just have it be a town event.
We won't charge you for the proclamation.
But I'm just asking, because I was not prepared.
When is Memorial Day? Memorial Day is May
29th. May 29th.
We
need a couple of weeks to be able
okay,
to...
Okay, well, one solution to this problem would be if the board decided to have town co-sponsor the event would be one solution to the problem. But rather than deciding right now on that question when most of us don't have that much information about exactly what's happening at the event, can I ask you to get us a letter requesting that we co-sponsor the event, and we'll put that on the agenda for a decision on May 17th?
16th.
That right. Doesn't give us very much time. That's what bothers me, and I guess you just have to deal with it. We need,
we'll make a decision on it.
We have to arrange speakers, and we have to put the program together.
Well,
but I guess maybe
I think
that's
we should
best.
Operate on the assumption that the event is going forward and that we'll make a decision about whether we're co-sponsoring it on May.
And can I go ahead and send the email, say, to Ms. Merman?
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
All right. Thank you all.
Thanks, Wes.
And, Steve, between now and then, if you all could look into what that special event policy might typically cost, because, my feeling is, I made this point last week in regard to the EarthFest that, while we're reviewing the policy, if we're going to give them $500, I felt like we should do that for anyone who comes in. And it may well be that amount would be sufficient to provide coverage for this event, and that would take care of it very simply. So appreciate that.
Yeah, I would hope that would be more than enough. All right, we'll look forward to a yet another discussion of special events insurance on May 16th and also June 13th.
Maybe our final discussion.
Okay.
Thanks.
We also have one matter that the Appearance Commission would like to address us about. Catherine Devine and Tom Wilberger are here from the Appearance Commission.
you got up on it.
Good evening.
How you doing?
Thanks.
Tom Sarah needs one of these also. I'm Catherine Devine, recently resigned appearance commissioner. This is Tom Wiltberger, who is a current appearance commissioner. Prior to my resignation, Tom and I together started cooking a plan to acknowledge and designate historic properties in Carrboro. What you're reading now, the Carrboro Historic Building Plaque Program, is not a historic society proposition, but an historic registration proposition, where we would invite owners of historic properties, both residential and commercial, to register and mark their properties with tasteful plaques. The objective of this project is to preserve and promote Carrboro's architectural history, to generate awareness of Carrboro's Milltown history and evolution. That's a nice teaching role that this program can play as we educate these property owners about just what they've got. To set a stage for walking tours and seasonal house tours with some potential fundraising potential. To encourage and motivate owners to maintain their property's appearance and structural integrity. And to build a sense of community among historic property owners and citizens. We're asking for your go-ahead to keep working on this. Together, Tom and I, with the help of the Brown Book, this is a 1983 publication published by the Friends of Old Carrboro, and I believe that Jay Bryan was the publisher back in 1983. Jay Bryan is one of our committee members. Richard Ellington is a committee member also, and we have enlisted Cheryl Forbes, who is meticulously renovating her old Carrboro bungalow at the end of Carr Street right now and is extremely knowledgeable, like encyclopedic, about architectural standards and history in Carrboro. We have those three volunteers. You have me as a volunteer now. I couldn't abandon this project because it has so much appeal for me. Tom and I together have databased this book. We know who owns every one of the properties in the Brown Book. We've added six or seven properties with the advice and consultation of Richard Ellington and Jay Bryan, who say, that's not featured in the book, but it needs to be invited to the program. This is how far we've gotten so far. Before proceeding farther, we would like to get a nod from you and from the town. There are some questions at the bottom that you're going to definitely ask, so I put them at the end of the document. What's it going to cost? It will cost a little bit of startup money in the form of photocopying and postage. We're not planning a big, expensive mailing. And the James Thomas, probably, as the liaison to the Appearance Commission, will we would hope that he would serve this program in the same way that he serves the commission in general, you know, telling us what we have on our agenda, for example. The Appearance Commission has a secondary charter, as you know. We are the Historic Preservation Commission, and that is a long-neglected aspect of their mission. Now that I'm no longer a commissioner, I have to say that. So what do you think, and do you have any questions?
Can you be, am I understanding correctly that you're in the phase of involving property owners in these five bulleted points?
We have not contacted property owners yet.
Okay.
We know,
so that's what you
we know who
do.
They are.
That's right.
And you're saying
the program doesn't exist yet.
We
are at the concept development stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are you asking us to contribute printing and postage for mailing to those property owners at this time? Is that...
Our understanding is that the Appearance Commission has about $380 in its budget, and we probably won't need any more than that.
$380.
More importantly,
do we need
the way we'd like to start to develop this program is to solicit the input of some of the current historic property owners. So that's why we built the database, is to do a mailing to invite them to a meeting. We've reserved this room on May 24th at 7 p.m. to say, hey, are you interested? Does this sound like something you'd participate in? This program is completely voluntary. The onus of researching the history of a property is also on the property owner. And the way these work in other towns, and you've all been to towns where you drive around like Hillsborough and see that this is the, you know, the W.B. Smith house, and it was built in, you know, 1803. Right. Those programs are voluntary, and the sign is actually purchased by the homeowner. Mm-hmm. And so the success of this program will be based upon how much participation we get. So we want your support to do a mailing with the town's name on it that says that this concept or idea is endorsed by A, the Appearance Commission, which we already have their endorsement, and the Town of Alderman. We'd actually like to stick the mailing in Town of Carborough envelopes and send it out.
Thank you.
I was a member of the
original
Friends of Old Carborough.
Friends of Old Carborough, and now I'm an Old Carborough member. It's just wonderful to see it coming to life again. I think homeowners would be very interested. For one thing, it would increase the value of their property, actually.
Don't
see
that.
A listing for historic. No, I mean.
You scare people away.
I know. Okay. I'm sorry.
You can't pay more taxes either.
No. Okay. I think it's a great idea.
Increase their pride of homeownership.
And there used to be a Friends of Old Carborough caroling, and there used to be a Friends of Old Carborough house tour, and it would just be so cool. So as the new liaison to you, I'd like to move a nod to the concept and encourage you to go forward. If I can get a second to my nod. Thank you.
Joel.
I just for organizational purposes, cannot this group just be a subcommittee of the Appearance Commission? Since, as you'd indicated, part of the...
It could be.
The Planning Committee is... In fact, we solicited some help from people who are not on the Appearance Commission.
You got four not commissioners involved right now.
However, what we intend is for there to be an application process, criteria to be set forth on who qualifies for what buildings qualify for plaques.
Right.
There has to be a body that approves and designates those plaques, and we saw the Appearance and Historic Preservation Commission as being the commission that has that authority.
Okay.
Question, remind me of, maybe you know the answer to this, and Anita's here. There was some sort of an archaeological or anthropological study done on Carborough, and some talks about creating a walkable tour of historical, not just the properties, but, you know, like our the historical...
I think you're referring to this era.
But that's the same thing?
Yes, it is. And when Friends of Old Carborough did... sponsor and organize events of the sort that you're describing. There were house tours. There were walking tours. There was caroling, as Jackie remembers, before my time. But we would love to resurrect that kind of spirit for Old Carborough.
What about going a little bit back on, I love it. I think it's a good idea. And part of our heritage is also, you know, we got the former slave cemeteries in Carborough, as well as Native American sites that would be good to be incorporated as part of this, you know.
I think that's a great point, and I think this program could evolve to include historic sites and other key landmarks around town. I think we're trying to jumpstart it with a few plaques that are going to be visible in town, and I think that'll begin to get some traction then. Which brings me to one more point about funding. The town owns a few historic properties like this building, and at some point we will probably approach the town to buy the sign to put in front of the properties that they own.
I think it's fabulous. One of the things I always love about going to Beaufort is looking at the plaques.
That's a good example, yeah.
It's fabulous, and I know people who live there on Ann Street who have purchased their own plaques. I think it helps to underscore how Carborough is a destination. So I absolutely support it. I think it's a great idea. Do you have an idea from the Brown Book how many households you're talking about?
We've got 80 databased right now.
80? And so do you see this as a one-time funding?
No. It's a program that needs that will need maintenance after it's off the ground.
I meant for that initial mailing. You're looking at you. Start a printing and postage. I was just asking.
Let me ask this: is this something that the board is comfortable with, just saying go ahead with right now, or because we should either do that, or we have a long agenda, we should either do that or put it on an agenda formally?
Yeah, and I think what they're asking is in cooperation with the Appearance Commission that they would use the Appearance Commission's budget to do this work. So we don't need to make any allocations. But just to let us know in the future that to kind of keep this thing rolling, that they may come hat in hand.
We'll keep you posted.
Don't have a motion in a second.
Okay.
Or not.
So it's been
I have one more little teasy thing to tell you. A very well-known local metal sculptor wants to make the plaques.
Cool. All right. Well, that's exciting.
Call it question.
Thank you.
All right. So it's been moved and seconded that we give the go-ahead to this proposal. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
And then... just real briefly, I would like to point out that, you know, usually when you get a letter from the IRS, it's not necessarily such an exciting thing. But we this year, the town of Carrboro, the Carrboro Board of Aldermen, it says here, we're presented a certificate of appreciation by the Internal Revenue Service for our role in helping with the VITA Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, Tax Counseling, and Tax Counseling for the Elderly program in assisting low-income and elderly citizens in our community in preparing their income tax returns. I thought that was nice. Appreciate such a positive message from the IRS. Okay, and with that, let's move on to the consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item 1 is approval of minutes of the previous meetings of April the 11th and April 18th. Item 2 is a request to set a public hearing for a conditional use permit request for the Jones Property Architecturally Integrated Subdivision for June 27th, 2006. Item 3 is a resolution accepting the sale price and transaction cost in exchange for transfer of a parcel at the southwest corner of Broad and Hill Streets from Orange County to the town of Carrboro.
Move the items.
Second. I just have a question about number 2. Well, so that I won't be confused, will it have information about any previous discussion we've had about this property? When we have the report from staff, I want to make sure I'm not confusing this piece of property with another piece of property where we had the representative of the developer come and speak about affordable housing.
That is the same property.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So that we're clear. All right.
Okay.
Great.
But if you could include that, because I probably will forget by June 27th. Right. Yeah. Just some little reference.
That's a great idea. All right. So the three items have been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Item D1, Mr. Manager.
Item D1 is a presentation of the manager's recommended budget for fiscal year 2006-2007. By state law, the manager is responsible for submitting a balanced budget for the Carrboro community to the Mayor Board of Aldermen. By June 1st, tonight, the board is being presented with a 2006-2007 recommended budget. The budget is submitted earlier than required by law in order to give you all an opportunity to have sufficient time to discuss the initiatives before approval. And if you don't mind, I will.
Please do.
Okay. You know, I was thinking this afternoon about the presentation tonight, and this will be my 29th budget presentation, including 2 years in another jurisdiction where we actually had two-year budgets, so two of those were actually two-year budgets. And I say that only because I'm the face of the budget presentation and the process, but my standing here represents the entire organization. I'm responsible for it, and I accept that responsibility, but we've got a great group of folks in this organization who help make this possible. I'd really like to thank Bing Rennig and all the department heads who are here tonight supporting this budget, and it's because of them that I think we have a good story to tell tonight. So with that, let's move on. Let's give you some of the highlights, and some of this is really dry, some of it's not quite as dry. This is the really dry stuff. This is the legal stuff, and I'll be very quick. You all know that our fiscal year is from July 1 to June 30th. We have to have a balanced budget. Unlike the federal government, we can't print it. I keep trying to get a printer in the budget, but nobody will let me do that. There are specific legal steps that we have to follow in preparing the budget. By April 30th, as this makes my head swim, April 30th or sooner, our department heads have to submit the budget. Obviously, we do that much more quickly than the state law requires. By June 1st, the budget message and the budget has to be presented. That's what we're doing tonight. And by July 1, the board has to adopt the budget and a budget ordinance. Historically, the board has always done the budget prior to July 1. And I also would mention that there is a public hearing requirement. The public hearing will be scheduled for May 23rd, the fourth Tuesday in May. We would anticipate that the budget would be adopted no later than June 20th. Of this year. The recommended budget is about almost $17.3 million, which is about a 4.9% increase over the current budget. And if you look at the pie charts, you can see that public safety and public works make up almost half of the proposed expenditure for next year. And I think it's pretty obvious that the primary mission of the budget process is to develop a plan for service delivery for our community. As a part of the budget process, we ask our departments to search for ways to create savings, find more revenues if possible, try to figure out ways to avoid cost, and make service quality improvements wherever we can. The budget review really is more than just talking about money. It's really looking and talking about what are the board priorities and how do we make the money available to put those priorities into action. Some of the highlights of the proposed budget for next year, really focusing in on the board's commitment to walkability and public transportation. This budget includes continuing the transit costs for fare-free bus service in our community. It provides for the initial debt service payments associated with things like the Adams Track. The anticipated interest on the first phase of the sidewalk bonds will be taking bids this spring, and hopefully we'll actually build some sidewalks this summer and fall, and we'll be paying interest on the first round of those bond-funded sidewalks. We also, as you all know, as a part of the grant requirements for the purchase of the Adams Track, made a commitment to develop a land management plan. A part of that land management plan requires that we do certain things in maintaining the property, including cleaning up and taking care of existing trails and looking to create new trails. The first year of the management plan would involve the town spending about $13,000, and hopefully in conjunction with the great volunteers we have in this community, to go out and make some improvements to existing trails and also create some new trails, and then continue on that in years afterwards. We also have money in this proposed budget for continuing with our traffic calming. We don't have specific projects identified. As you all know, we have a petition process, and the latest example of that are the speed tables on High Street, if you've been through there lately. I'll put in a plug for our Public Works Department. That was an in-house project, and I think it's been really well received by the residents on High Street. This $17.3 million budget also incorporates many of the projects that we talked with you about when we talked about the capital improvement program back last fall. We'll be able to follow the board policy of replacement of vehicles and equipment, and that's about $1.2 million and will enable us to make sure that we have the right equipment, the right fleet.
to provide services to the community. We're also are proposing to begin staffing for the new fire station that hopefully will come online in a couple of years. The proposal is that we would add 5 firefighters in April of 2007. As you all know, as we've talked about for several years now, we anticipate up to 15 firefighters needed to staff the new substation. This would allow us to start that process of getting those firefighters trained and prepared, and so that by the time the new fire substation opens, we'd hope to have all 15 firefighters trained and ready to respond. There are also a number of technology improvements in the budget. Again, part of the capital improvement program, I'll mention a few of them. Police records management system, which will really allow a much more sophisticated process for our police officers, particularly out in the field. Along with that, wireless PC technology in our police and fire vehicles. We also were proposing a new, what we call an eGov initiative, that will provide access for our residents 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It will be a portal into our website, give folks an opportunity to send in complaints, requests, concerns. We'll have a formal tracking mechanism in place so that hopefully we'll avoid anybody's concerns falling through the cracks. We'll have somebody assigned to track that, make sure it gets to the right department, and make sure the resident who makes the inquiry gets the appropriate feedback. We also, again, as a part of the CIP, are proposing setting aside funds for our street resurfacing program, reserving money for the eventual reconstruction of Weaver Street and the eventual replacement of the Gary Road stormwater. And this budget proposes to continue our pay-for-performance program that the board approved a couple of years ago, and would continue to pay for our increased cost of health insurance for our employees. Some other proposed changes for next year's budget include some other cost increases, primarily due to inflation. Just like for all of us who drive up to the pumps, the town has to drive up to the pump, and our costs have increased as well. We also have had some increases in our workers' compensation and property liability coverage. We're hopeful that we'll have adequate funding in place, particularly for fuel, and as we did in the current year, we have a $20,000 contingency proposed in case we get into an emergency situation and fuel prices spike, that hopefully we'll have enough to cover that. We continue to look for every opportunity to provide or to purchase more fuel-efficient vehicles and looking towards alternative fuel vehicles whenever we can, as evidenced by the recent Civic Hybrid that we purchased for one of our administrative staff in the police department. Some what we believe will be improved service levels. In addition to the 5 firefighters that we're proposing to add next spring, we're proposing to add one other position in this budget. That's an engineering technician in the Public Works Department who will assist in managing capital projects, plan review, and serving as a liaison from Public Works to our consulting engineer. We also are proposing a small amount of money to begin an employee fitness program in conjunction with Carolina Fitness next door to the fire department. We also, based on conversations from the board and trying to reach out to all segments of the community to make sure that we continue to be an inclusive community, is to propose $5,000 for translation equipment for community-wide town meetings that would be for our non-English-speaking residents. When there are important town-wide meetings, we would have the equipment in place to do that, and you all would have to help us find the appropriate interpreters to do that. Another very large ticket item is money proposed in the budget to move towards an 800 megahertz radio system that would initially be for police and fire. Orange County is converting to this system, as is Chapel Hill. We're working in conjunction with them. I know you all have heard a lot about this idea of interoperability. It's a significant problem right now in our public safety area. Although our folks did an absolute superb job in the incident that involved at the pit back in March and spilled over into Carrboro, it became very evident that interoperability was an issue for us because it was difficult sometimes to communicate between police and fire because of the differences in the radio frequencies. This, over time, will correct that situation, provide for a much more safe situation for our police officers and our firefighters. This budget continues, as I hope in the time that I've been here, tries to continue to focus on fiscal discipline and continually improving the kind of work that we do. For example, rather than just allow one-time costs to continue as a part of our base budget, each year we look at those one-time costs, and if they go away, then we pull those out of the base budget so that a department doesn't. Nice music.
It's her birthday, it's
my son's.
I was going to sing, but that's the wrong tune.
Checking in.
Anyway, we've removed those one-time costs from the base budget. We also have identified almost $85,000 in savings. You all were briefed on this last year. We also briefed the school district, and that is, for some years, the town of Chapel Hill has had its school resource officers and its school crossing guards paid for through the Chapel Hill Carborough School District budget. However, in Carborough, those costs have been borne by the taxpayers in Carborough, so that meant that folks paying the district tax in Carborough were helping to pay for those same positions in Chapel Hill and paying 100% of those costs in the town of Carborough. I think to anybody's way of thinking, that's an inequitable situation. We advised the school district last year that the budget for this coming year would include transferring those costs appropriately, I think, to the school district. We've notified them, and this budget does that. We also have identified about $9,500 in savings with our phone system by bundling under one contract. Excuse me, over a two-year period, that'll save us about $22,000, and that's largely due to the work of Andy Vogel in really looking at our contracts and making sure we were getting the biggest bang for the buck. I'd also like to say that this budget represents the second year in a row where there will be no proposed tax increase for the residents of the town of Carborough. And that also marks three of the last 4 years in which there's been no tax increase. Looking on the revenue side, we anticipate a net increase of about $800,000 in the budget, and I'm not going to point all these out, but I know you all know that our two primary revenue sources are the property tax and our local sales tax, and those are the areas that we see the increases. We see a decrease in grant revenue, and that's primarily because we had a one-time grant for the Roberson Street bike path that will be bringing hopefully a contract for you all to look at in a couple of weeks. That won't be in next year's budget, so grant funding is down. And other financing sources, you'll also see a decline in that because our fiscal year 06-07 capital improvement program equipment and vehicle replacement schedule calls for a lower expenditure in funding for next year, so therefore we won't be using as much installment purchasing for next year. This budget will also allow us to maintain the board's policy of our undesignated fund balance remaining between 22.5% and 35%, and I think you all know my goal is to keep it closer to the 35 than the 22.5, and I believe this budget will accomplish that. Summarizing. I think that this budget does support the strategic priorities and goals that have been established by you all. It funds almost all of the CIP initiatives that were planned for next year. I do think it promotes fiscal discipline and continuous improvement within our organization. And again, our property tax rate of 62.44 cents is recommended to remain at its current level. Looking to the future. In the future, the impact of the capital improvement program will create some pressures on the operating budget. We've talked about that before. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. What also shouldn't be a surprise is that I've made a commitment that we will try to manage that CIP in a way that it'll have a minimal impact on our future tax rates. But what that means, folks, is that we're going to have fiscal discipline to be able to focus on our existing service levels and really to be thoughtful about new initiatives, whether it's operational or capital, and think about if we're going to add something, where might we cut back somewhere else? Otherwise, the pressure on the tax rates in the future will be significant. We continue to look for improvement opportunities within the organization. We're looking right now at some energy efficiency ideas for town facilities. We're looking at additional wellness programs for our employees to try to reduce our claims experiences in the future. You all know those have been quite high and have had a very negative impact on our premium cost for employee health insurance. We also are looking at some other options for retiree health insurance because at least a portion of the increases we've seen over the last couple of years have been driven by our retirees. We want to do something that balances the need to take care of folks who have taken care of this town through their commitments and years of service, but at the same time have a plan in place that we can afford for our current employees as well. And then we're working, as you all know, to develop a more formalized strategy of continuous improvement with our employees through what we are calling a Better Together project, where we have teams of employees working across departmental lines, working together, trying to figure out how we build on the successes that we've had in the past and to move the town of Carrboro forward in the kind of positive way that I think you all expect and our residents expect. And that's it, folks. Thank you.
That was my comment.
Yeah.
Bing. Bing. Hey, Bing. Thank you. And all the staff. And all the staff.
Let me great mention, I forgot to mention
this. Next week's work session, May 9th, is, unless you all direct otherwise, would be devoted entirely to a budget work session. We've got three outside presenters coming to hit different aspects of the budget, and then time for you all to discuss whatever you'd like to discuss as a part of the budget.
Okay.
Good job, Steve.
Thank you.
Good job, Ben.
Great job.
So we can wait till keep us next on the week.
Board members, I thought this was going to be a long agenda, but maybe not. Does anybody have any further comments they want to get into on the budget right now?
No.
I want to make a comment.
Please.
Because I think we all agree that the staff has done a really great job putting together this budget that accomplishes so much without increasing taxes. But a little bit obscure during this presentation is the fact that some of the biggest cost increases that are accommodated are for things beyond our control. Like there's a big increase in the cost of health insurance, and people probably saw the front page article in the paper this morning pointing out that in England, health care costs half what it does here, and people are healthier. Just the latest of a string of studies. So this is a national problem that we have to deal with those costs on the local level. And it's something I think citizens should be aware of. Another big factor affecting both the transit budget and our local fleet fuel budget, is the cost of fuel and the fact that gas is going up. And obviously that's a complex topic, but we know that both in terms of the whole political economy of oil and also the fact that the fuel economy standards placed on the auto industry are, stuck in the 1970s and have been. Those are national policy decisions that are beyond our control, but that we have to grapple with the costs of that. So I think, it's important to bear that in mind in considering, in fact, what a great job the staff is doing accommodating those kinds of externally imposed, you might say, cost increases and still bring in this kind of budget.
Can I add one thing to that? One of the major costs that we saw in there was for the radios. And supposedly, almost 5 years ago, Homeland Security money was supposed to be available to make those radios available to everybody. And I don't know what Halberton's done with that money, but we haven't gotten it. So that's another cost.
Look east, far, far east.
But we hold out some hope that we'll get some radio funding from Homeland Security.
And we have gotten some funding through our cooperative efforts with Orange County and Chapel Hill to fund about 25 radios, far short of what we need. And we do have plans to apply for a
grant in the fall for $100,000, which could mitigate some of the cost in 07-08. But having said that, we're still potentially looking at $400,000 or $500,000 over the next 2 years. The good news about that is we're able to piggyback not only on Orange County, but the State Highway Patrol system. If not for that, our local cost would be substantially higher.
And the other good news is things could change in November.
It's remarkable to keep the fund balance ratio at 22.5 to the 35%, having been to the Institute of Government and seeing how tough it is for municipalities to get into that ratio. I must commend you for doing it. It's really impressive.
Okay. I just want to say thank you again for the no tax increase budget. I think you're going to very soon you're going to earn the title of magician because services and quality of customer service keep improving, and I think that e-government initiative I'm sure is going to be a success and it continue to those are the thinking outside the box and cutting edge initiatives that will keep Scarborough the progressive town that it is today, and it will continue to believe to be a cost savings device. And as Randy mentioned, I think the fund balance being over 30% is the best savings account that one can have for the worst crisis that we can have in this town, and especially when you, Governor, can also take away some of your revenues. We know we have a cushion there to respond for if worse comes to shove. Thank you, and thank you for all this stuff. I love the way you had really involved the participation of everybody, and also not just in the savings, but also in creating a whole culture that is strong, is healthy, that you know it looks for the best interest of the town as well as the individuals. I think that's exactly what Carborough is supports, and that's how sustainable development begins. So thank you.
Thank you.
I would only add that I think it's important to note that, you know, Steve, this is your second budget with us, and that when we hired Steve, that was a long and difficult process, and we took the decision to hire the person who we really felt would do the right thing with the organization, and I think it's paying off, particularly given the fact that we knew we had a great management team in place, and all we needed was somebody to help us all get rowing together in the same boat, and I think Steve's done a remarkable job with that, and our department heads have done a remarkable job in embracing the new culture and making it work that I think John just talked about. So everybody deserves credit for this.
Absolutely.
Ditto, ditto.
Okay. Moving on our agenda, so we'll pick up more discussion on the budget next Tuesday. Moving on our agenda to item D2, a presentation of an interim report on the development of the solid waste management plan.
Before Gail and Blair get started, can I ask you all if you would consider adoption of the resolution setting the work session for next Tuesday?
So
all right. It's been moved and seconded that we set that. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. We have with us tonight two employees of Orange County who I think we should just pause and note that when solid waste management planning became a serious topic in North Carolina, began to be a state-mandated topic in North Carolina back in, I think, 1990 or so, 1989, I think, an aggressive goal was set by the state of North Carolina for what communities should accomplish in solid waste landfilling reduction, and that Orange County was the first county to really embrace and actually accomplish the goals that were set out for us by the state. And we're proud to say that, and the two people who deserve most credit for getting us there are here with us tonight, Blair Pollack and Gil Wilson.
Thank you for the kind words.
Blair's going to conduct the presentation tonight. He is our lead staff person on the planning process, and then we'll both take questions afterward.
Thanks, Gil.
Before I get started, I want to thank you all with my Earth Action Fest hat on for your flexibility and responsiveness to the festival. I understand from feedback from others it came off real well, and we hope to do it again next year with a little more advanced planning. And on a historical note, I want to say a scant 22 years ago, I was working with Steve in the Apex town government, and one of the key issues we worked on was creating an energy conservation plan for the town of Apex to drive down their energy costs in the face of rising energy costs. So this is hardly new, but it's a little more dire this time, so it seems. Our presentation tonight is basically an update for you all on the status of the solid waste management planning process. It seems like we're in a constant state of planning at the same time that we are making these improvements towards our waste reduction goals. And so the increments that we've done are almost on a parallel track to this master plan that we've been working really hard to put together. A few years ago, in 2000, when the solid waste responsibility shifted from the town of Chapel Hill as the lead agency with the landfill owners group to the county with the Solid Waste Advisory Board as a board appointed by you all, the county also at least nominally took the lead in the solid waste planning process, as well as daily operations for recycling and running the landfill on behalf of all the residents of Orange County. That's worked out real well. We think that the Solid Waste Advisory Board's involvement in helping to produce this plan has been integral to our success in keeping everybody on board. It's not an adversarial type of relationship where the county runs the landfill and the towns have to come and pay, and there's this kind of constant tension, whereas in a lot of other communities that's definitely the case. And last, it says in the memo, last February, and now this means February of 2005, the Board of Orange County Commissioners instructed the Solid Waste Advisory Board to initiate a formal solid waste planning process. And one of the first things that the Solid Waste Advisory Board did was to create a broader group that also, in addition to the eight members of the Solid Waste Advisory Board, brought in an elected official and a key staff person from each of the four local governments to be involved in creating the solid waste plan. I don't want to get into the details, but if you do have this memo in front of you, I do want to highlight a couple of things about the process that we've engaged in the last year, because I think some of the key issues that the work group has identified will continue to be key to our success in creating a plan that's going to bring us from our current 45% level of waste reduction to the 61% goal. So the work group has met seven times, the most recent time being this past April, since April of 2005. And in fact, the bullet list of the April 2005 meeting does point out some of the key issues that the work group raised and that will continue to, I think, capture a lot of the work and attention of the individual boards as well as us as a group. Meeting the 61% goal, making a transition in the 2009-10 year from a landfill to a transfer station, that'll be a really big deal, because the fact of the matter is the landfill makes money for the county, which still continues to support the recycling program. The transfer station will be a large expense, will make less money, and will put considerable fiscal pressure on us. Handling commercial waste, and there are several important elements to that. One is we want to make sure that the towns and the county have a way to continue to capture our commercial waste, both so that we can gain income from it at the landfill, and also so that we have some control over the stream of commercial waste, so we can regulate it properly and enforce our bans and on cardboard, scrap metal, clean wood, and other bans that you all may put in place. The way the system is right now, it's fairly flexible and open and in transition. So commercial area is the area that has had the least attention for recycling, and also the area that has been is probably the vaguest. We all provide public residential collection services, all four governments do, and the spectrum of collection services range in the three municipalities in the county, from no commercial services in Orange County to a kind of mixed system in Carver of public collections competing with the private, Hillsborough having a single franchise where the town has collects the money and has one franchise contractor and directs, importantly from our perspective, directs all the waste under that franchise contract to the landfill, and then Chapel Hill, which is predominantly public with some private competition, allocating recycling fees among the various programs. Recycling fee right now, the 3R fee accounts for about 70% of program revenue. We hope to raise that to close to 100% of our costs for the recycling programs, but there's continuing demand for new programs, including especially the commercial program. Residential cardboard collection is a big issue that we have not grappled with yet. Expansions to commercial recycling, pay-as-you-throw, and its effect on particularly dumpster systems, so where we have open dumpsters all over the county and the towns and UNC. Consideration or reconsideration, really, of a materials recovery facility. Should we, the ongoing question of should we process our materials locally as we collect more varied and higher volume of materials, or should we contract that out? The future tipping fees, how to achieve higher recycling rates to help get us from the 45% waste reduction to 61%. Integration of recycling with landfilling and transfer station composting and so on. What are the practical limits to recycling? Just as a single note, we're now capturing about 70% of the newspaper in the residential waste stream. So, you know, how much harder can we squeeze that turnip? Whereas we're only capturing 25% of the plastic bottles, but they don't weigh that much. The need for other disposal options. Gail's been in dialogue with Durham. We're contemplating where the waste that gets collected at the transfer station is going to go, where the transfer station is going to be. These are critical issues. Financing of the overall system is quite important, and private sector compliance with our fairly rigorous regulatory environment here. The subsequent meetings grappled with some of these issues in more detail, and we continued to present a series of technical papers regarding, for example, the future of the drop-off sites, the costs of pay-as-you-throw. That's been a hot topic in some communities, and there are some costs to implementing a pay-as-you-throw system, so that continues to be on the agenda. I want to wind up by talking about what this process could look like going forward. There's kind of two objectives that are folded together. One is we're under a statutory obligation to have a 3-year update to the state solid waste plan. That's due June 30th, and we've already collectively, tacitly decided we will not make the June 30th deadline with the state of North Carolina in order to conduct our process really deliberately and carefully and cooperatively. So we're in the midst of it right now. The very next important step will be getting a technical report from our consultant on the recycling programs, and it's going to address several important issues. It's going to give us some costs on building our own materials recovery facility versus sending materials out of county. It's going to address the broad issue of commercial recycling, the different ways that we could approach that, whether it's franchise, collecting ourselves, some of the costs and the benefits of doing either of those, and the expansion of our existing residential program. So we'll have for you all, for the representatives, for your representatives on the solid waste work group, the SWAB representatives, and back to this board in the fall, a fairly rigorous technical document that'll enable us to do some good decision making. Using that technical document and the work that the staff has done on solid waste disposal, we're going to put together a draft plan. And our sort of straw schedule with the plan is for the work group to meet, we hope, at least one more time before the end of this fiscal year and give us our marching orders for the summer. So we have some work to do to be able to bring you a plan in September. To circulate that around to the various local governments for comments and a formal presentation like this, as well as informally with staff from each of the local governments, sanitation people, solid waste folks, and solid waste advisory boards. Once we get comments back from you all, taking that revised draft plan out for public comment and then bringing it back one more time for a final revision to the Board of County Commissioners and then getting everybody's approval. And our objective is to finish that by the end of calendar 2006. It's a one of the things that we've done in, to help move this forward is give a survey of important decision points, and I believe with your packet you've gotten a copy of this survey. It just gives you some idea of the broad list of items that we're trying to address, everything from do we issue a second recycling bin to every household when we start collecting mixed paper and other items, to do we give them a roll cart all the way through, do we franchise out commercial recycling collection, or do we try to build our own commercial recycling staff and capacity. So there's quite a bit in there. We do hope that every member of the work group will complete the survey once they get the technical report at the end of this month, and that'll give you all some additional decision-making capabilities. I do want to close by talking a little bit more again about the solid waste part of this, because we have focused so much on the recycling and waste reduction part, almost to the detriment of what is sort of our perversely meat and potatoes of the operation. It does we do run two landfills. We do manage over 80,000 tons of waste at those landfills every year, and they're really critical operations. Getting the waste, controlling our waste, managing it properly, regulating it properly are all important parts of what we do. As we look as the unincorporated part of the county at a franchise type of approach to providing solid waste collection services to unincorporated Orange County, there are some real opportunities for the towns to contemplate how they might interact with that, not so much for residential waste, but possibly for commercial waste, the way that Hillsborough has done. We think the system that they've put in place there has worked to the town's benefit fiscally as well as to the landfill's benefit in terms of controlling the flow of materials and enabling us to regulate it, keep the cardboard out in the future, keeping electronics out, plastic bottles, oil filters, all the things that are banned by the state. I want to close with that and just ask Gail if he wants to add anything.
No, you're pretty thorough. Thank you.
Okay. And ask you all if you have any questions at this point.
Joel.
I have actually a couple of questions. The cost of pay-as-you-throw, and I can't remember, has any jurisdiction done a study of pay-as-you-throw? Now, I want to think that Chapel Hill did it one time, but I'm not sure.
Yes, they've done a couple of studies. The most recent one was actually during this fiscal year sometime. And there's two components to that, one of which is the administrative costs, and the other one is the actual operating costs. And probably their Public Works Department director could put their hands on that for you.
Could I get a copy of that? That's one question. And I guess, I like sort of the process it's going through, and I have other comments for the board after people finish asking questions. Do you have a sense of where that other 30% of the newspaper is coming from? I'm just curious if there's a method to that. Or
Every 5 years we pay a handsome sum of money to people to pick through our garbage. So in April of 2005, we picked through 57 loads of garbage, and because proportionately about half of our garbage is residential, half of the samples were residential, and then we sub-proportioned it. Carborough's this much, Chapel Hill's this much, and so forth. So, yeah, we could glad to present you with the data on the waste sort, if you like.
Actually, I would like that. I know it sounds crazy, but...
Well, you're on your way to
it's
fascination with waste. But we have those data. Now, I will caveat the data a little bit by saying that the sample size, once you get down to the subsample of the Carborough residential segment, is small. So your inner statistician might say, I don't really know if I trust those numbers. But collectively, it's reasonable to say we recycled whatever it was, about 4,000 tons of newsprint last year, and we... remaining in the garbage as a percent was whatever that that number is, like 1,500 tons. So that particular element.
really briefly. Concern I have is and I know we're still in the process, is where this is, this waste is going to end up. You know, the two industries that are growing rapidly in the United States, one is in economically depressed towns, one is the buildup of yields, which is a trading commodity today in Wall Street, and the other one is waste management and or landfills. And I think Orange County has a proud tradition of being non-environmentally sensitive, but socially and responsible. And I want to make sure we do the right thing on analyzing, taking into account where we're going to send that waste. The other issue is I was attending in Charlotte this year the National League of Cities Conference. And in the expo, there were about, I don't know, like 3,000 or 1,000 expos. And one that caught my eye was a company that does recycle benches and bike racks and stuff that I can see us having here for free. And they have also recycled beans, and they collect them themselves. I'm like, how do you pay for all this? You know, they do it free, they maintain it, they clean it, they sort it, and it's by advertising. So I just want to give you that tip that I don't know how ugly it might be, and also I said, so, you know, I mean, is it like Walmart's going to take? I said, that the town gets to pick who advertises, and there's a contract written where you can actually select, you know, or have a say on what kind of advertising you can place on that, but I saw it as a creative way to get recycling done for free, bike racks for free, benches for free, bus stations for free. So it might be worth looking into that too.
Years ago, New York City got all their garbage, street garbage cans financed by selling advertising around the sides of it. So if you want to go that route, it's there's certainly some fiscal gain to be had in the trade-off for that approach, and we'd be glad to look into that and try to go back to the League of Cities list of vendors and see who that is. So we'll be glad to take some direction from you all as well as the other boards on that. I did want to respond briefly, if I might, to your earlier comment, Alderman, about the how the landfill site is going to be selected. Tomorrow night at our Solid Waste Advisory Board meeting, the board will be addressing criteria for both a materials recovery facility if we choose to go elsewhere, as well as landfill if we choose to go elsewhere. And looking at their preliminary discussions on it over the last 3 months, I'm certain that cost, at least cost, will only be one of the elements that they're looking at. The trick has been, frankly, to try to quantify some of the issues around community relations and environmental issues and at other landfills, and how you actually make those into variables that you can rank against one another, where you can rank sites against one another. But they are in fact working on that, and your two board members, Al Vickers and Linda Bowerman, have been active participants in that conversation, trying to develop those criteria.
Well, I wasn't going to say this, but I need to disagree with John, which is I'm opposed to the commercialization of public space, whether it's the town commons or garbage cans or dumpsters or whatever. So I don't know if we need to have a conversation about that at this juncture, but I certainly disagree with that. And I will disagree, since our Dues and Observer reporter isn't here. I don't have to bicker, but I can bicker otherwise.
I disagree without him bickering.
I like bicker.
Anyway, but to the points I wanted to make, we have a Vision 2020 document that outlines our vision for the future of Carrboro, and there's a solid waste section in there. And two of the points that are stressed, one is the town's interest in pay-as-you-throw, and one is our interest in some sort of neighborhood composting program. And I didn't hear, in your brief presentation, I didn't hear any discussion of composting, so I'm interested in whatever you can tell us about that. And also, in terms of the pay-as-you-throw, my specific question is what you know about the experience of other communities in terms of the problem you mentioned with waste winding up in dumpsters, and how serious a problem that has been or how prevalent.
You want that now?
Yeah.
Okay. well,
if you don't mind.
Well, not at all. I'm happy to talk about it. I just didn't know how much you guys wanted to get into this, but we're happy to. We always like the opportunity to talk trash.
right place.
But please, no bickering. Go ahead.
I like bickering.
I think we're among friends here. The impact of pay as you throw on the positive side and the negative side differ from community to community. I wouldn't say that the, whatever you want to call it, illegal dumping or waste shifting or whatever is a red herring, but generally, historically, there's been a bump in illegal disposal, and it usually goes away after a few months. I mean, as a parallel, the city of Charlottesville, where the town of Chapel Hill's current public works director is from, very much like us, small community with a big university, a lot of open dumpsters, a lot of students, et cetera, went through a pay-as-you-throw regime, and sure enough, you know, for a few months, garbage ended up in the university's dumpsters, and with some rigorous enforcement, it stopped. It ended up illegally dumped, but it stopped after a while. There had to be some locking of dumpsters, and people had to pay more attention to this, but it can be an effective strategy, and it's a short-term pain. The fact of the matter is, I can just tell this little story about the town of Chapel Hill's attorney living near the Culberth Middle School and repeatedly seeing the teachers and janitors and so on who didn't necessarily live in Orange County unloading their waste in the school's dumpsters when they came into work. And his favorite line was theft of services, because the town ended up paying for that when those dumpsters went to the landfill. So if you want to start looking in bags of garbage, getting addresses and doing theft of services, it'll stop soon enough. It does. And to the point about community composting, I'm not trying to be too light about it, but the fact of the matter is, in this community, it would behoove us to do it all at once if we can, for Chapel Hill, Carver, Hillsboro, and probably the county at the solid waste convenience centers to make a coordinated move. It would be a little bit harder if, say, Carver did it 1 year, waste shifted to Chapel Hill, and Chapel Hill did it the next year, waste shifted to the university, and so on. And it would all shift to the convenience centers if those remained free dumping for anybody in Orange County. So that's a fairly large political nut to crack, but I think it's doable, and I think it could be an effective strategy for us all in terms of reducing waste and increasing recycling.
Alex? Just very briefly, I mean, I had just in historical context, there has, and there may no longer really be, but there has been divided opinion on this board as to, from a philosophical standpoint, as to whether we wanted to move to a pay-as-you-throw system. Some data that I'd be interested in seeing, if there is any extant, and we may have seen it years and years ago when we last had this discussion, so I beg your forgiveness if I've forgotten that, but is the relationship between family income and waste generation. And the whole philosophical issue that I have is that unless one can show a correlation between family income and waste generation, then you end up with what is an inherently regressive revenue-raising option. If one assumes that a family of X size, regardless of family income, generates X amount of waste, then by using pay-as-you-throw as a behavior modification device using economic incentive or disincentive as the weapon, then those who are incentivized are those who have, if you will, the least resources to deal with it. Those who are least incentivized are those with plenty of resources. So that's a social equity issue that I've raised previously when we've had this conversation. And I thought I'd just raise it again, understanding the benefits that pay-as-you-throw offers in many, many instances. So I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Well, I imagine it's not as hot of a topic as it once was, but the flip of that is there's probably a little more data been collected over the last 10 years since this was really a hot topic, and we'd be glad to present some as you all get deeper into that.
Can I respond just briefly to Alex's question?
Staying on pay-as-you-throw for a minute.
Just briefly, I think the counter to that is that already We're not making that distinction. All families are paying the same. And if we do have pay-as-you-throw, it gives households the opportunity to pay less by reducing their waste. And it also means that for households that are truly needy households or, you know, economically disadvantaged, that the town can provide waste services for them, thereby actually lowering their costs. And that can be built into the program. But
anyway. Alex, one of the ways that some communities have dealt with it, to speak to Dan's point, is if you use a bag program, a special color bag, then if you want to, you can issue more bags or free bags or whatever to those households that you think qualify for that. So that's one way to deal with that issue.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on Dan's in agreement that several years ago when this came up, one of the reasons to go with pay-as-you-throw is that we cannot say people Z don't have any increase in taxes or get a tax break, because we have to treat everybody the same regardless of age or economic group when it comes to taxes. But we do have wiggle room when it comes to fees. And so if we change from a tax to a fee, then we can waive that fee for certain. You can do some creative budget things with this that actually really benefit low-income households.
Just as last time, if somebody were able, I'm willing to be convinced if somebody can present a solid plan for addressing
how
these issues.
Right.
Last time around, nobody did.
Right.
So let's be clear about that.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I just want to say, you know, I think all three boards have to decide. I think the big elephant in the middle of the room is, what are you going to do with it and where it's going to go? Now, I'm here to tell you, as long as I'm on the board, I'm not going to vote for an expansion of the landfill where it is unless the four jurisdictions decide in those areas where the landfill is. Because it's not one of those great things that people say, oh, please put a landfill in my neighborhood. Then we need to provide other services or capital expenditures there. Mm-hmm. It seems to me it is unfair for us. You know, we really don't discuss it. And this is just a big rant of mine, so I'm going to take 30 seconds. I'm going to try to do it under 15. But we cannot continue, at some point. Now, I'm not mad at y'all. So y'all can even sit down if you want to, unless other people have want to talk to you. But at some point, we need to decide where that waste is going to go. It's either going to go, unfortunately, in the same place it is now, and it's not their fault, or it's going to go somewhere else. And if it's going to go somewhere else, I can assure you, it's not going on Weaver Dairy Road. If it does, I will be incredibly shocked. There are neighborhoods that will fight you to the death before you put it there. And that needs to be a discussion. And I let Carlberg be the first to say, if we're going to put it in a low-income neighborhood in Orange County, then we need to talk about other services for that neighborhood. There's got to be a big crow pit, because that means my trash is not smelling up in my neighborhood. And I dare anybody who opposes putting it near their neighborhood when another neighborhood has had the burden of having it for 25 years of letting their trash pile up and get smelly. I dare anybody to do it. That's all I have to say.
Damn, skipping.
As I recall, not to pick on Weaver Dairy Red, but I do recall presiding over public hearings where they fought against East Chapel Hill High School being located there. Anyway.
Mark, I wanted to make a comment.
Yes.
I wanted to commend SWAB on the questionnaire. I thought it was excellent. The closest transfer station, where is that?
Existing transfer station, not landfill, but existing transfer station? I guess it's the one in the city of Dewey.
There are three reasonably the same distance. One is the city of Durham's, which is off of Club Boulevard, north of Durham. Uh-huh. And there are two in RTP owned by private companies. They're rather small facilities, but they're transfer stations nevertheless.
So would Orange County be looking at creating its own transfer station or piggybacking onto one of the pre-existing?
We're considering both. In fact, I went with Manager John Lincoln, Assistant Manager Rod Bisser this morning and met with representatives from Durham to explore options to sharing transfer facilities with Durham and what are the economics of that and so forth. Also, the Solid Waste Advisory Board has recommended that the county develop their own transfer station in county. So as we work through that over the next few months, hopefully some decision will be made. So we're looking at a number of options.
Mm-hmm. We have one citizen who wants to speak on this topic, and I'd like you guys to stay nearby, but if I could recognize Bob Kirshner, if you would come up and speak, and then I want to share a few thoughts.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you recognizing me. I know half the board here at least will remember me for a few years ago when I spoke on this very subject. It's just some information on a level of sensitivity that I would like you to be aware of. With shared interest communities, particularly that with close high densities such as a townhome community, because of the layout that we have, we are required to have dumpsters. We don't have room for roll-out bins or recycled bins. When it comes to I want to bring up the level of cardboard. You were talking about you're not quite sure what to do about cardboard. In a community such as ours, we are required to have a separate cardboard dumpster. And we bear that entire burden. We have to pay for the dumpster, the rental dumpster, and the emptying of that dumpster. And, you know, so we want, which is a service, even with the fee that we pay to the county, including our taxes, where single family homes are, you know, they put their cardboard out with the recycle bins. We're paying for that, even though we have to pay for our cardboard 100% ourselves. Now, we do draw our best to keep the regular dumpsters clear. In our community specifically, we hired a crew to actually check the dumpsters for contraband and to clear it out the best we can. I can't say we're 100%, but we put a darn hard try at it at our own expense on that. So I just want to put a level of awareness and a level of sensitivity to there are communities that are, as opposed to single family, multi-family communities tend to, you know, bear more of a cost on things that we don't get benefit from. So I just wanted to bring that up and appreciate your consideration on that.
Thanks, Bob.
Can I make one?
Yeah, please do.
Presently, cardboard is not collected curbside residential either. Certainly, that's a major topic as we go forward to develop the plan. And I hope that the plan recommendation includes cardboard, both residential curbside and some level of commercial provision of cardboard as well.
Not commercial, residential,
just multifamily. Yeah, this is always a term. In the solid waste industry, commercial has to do with the type of service, and a dumpster is a commercial type of service, commercial. Although you clearly live in a residential area.
Right. I just want to add to that. I really appreciate the point that that you're making about that, Bob. And, you know, I would like to add, we've had some discussion at the Solid Waste Advisory Board meetings about this. And, you know, the university understandably has a lot of reservations about pay-as-you-throw, for example, simply because they've got an awful lot of dumpsters to police, if that's what it comes to. I'm sympathetic with Bob's point. I'm involved in the management of a homeowners association at a condominium. We have all the same issues to deal with. It is a real... it is a real difficulty and it's a real issue, but ultimately what this whole process is about is finding ways to make each and every one of us as individuals and our various institutions that we're part of more accountable for what happens at their trash can. And, I think Alex's point is well made about pay-as-you-throw that don't want to hear about how it, well, it could be made equitable. I want to hear about, like, how are we going to make it equitable if that's the path we're gonna follow. Let's talk about how will that really work. And I would also point out that pay-as-you-throw as a collection system, there's a lot of, in some areas, pay-as-you-throw systems have been used primarily as a way of funding the, as a revenue source, as a way of funding the actual solid waste management operations. But it's also possible to set the fees lower so that it's not really about the money, the income that comes from the pay-as-you-throw system, but instead is about the kind of nuisance fee that you put out there that increases the level of awareness and increases the level of accountability about what goes in the trash can. I wanted to have this whole topic on our agenda because I think some of these issues, you know, I've sort of been out representing y'all about this, and I know what I think about a lot of these issues, and I have a pretty good idea what how y'all would feel about a lot of them, but there are also a bunch that I don't. Pay-as-you-throw is one. But let me point out also that, you know, almost every, essentially every scenario, well, short of us partnering with Durham or something like that to use their existing transfer station, every other scenario, it seems to me, involves having a transfer station somewhere in Orange County. And we need to, you know, I'm not saying we need to endorse that blindly without knowing what it would look like or where it would go, but I think we need to begin to think about the reality of that and how that will work and where it might be and the implications behind that, so that that issue does not sneak up on us as a community. I think it's also important to realize that there's been a lot of discussion about a materials recovery facility, or MRF, as it is sometimes called for short. And, you know, there's, I think one of the really critical issues here is whether if we are going to have a materials recovery facility, and I think in order to meet the kind of goals that we've set for ourselves, we at some level must have a type of materials recovery facility that we're working with. It can be a commercial operation that's out of county and that we don't have a lot of control. We you know, sign maybe a five-year contract or something, but at the end of your five-year contract, they can raise their prices. So we ultimately don't have that much control over pricing if we go down that path. On the other hand, if it's possible that we could establish our own materials recovery facility in our community, but there again, we have to ask ourselves, where would that be? And how would that work, and what kind of impact would that have? It would not be some kind of disastrously awful facility. I think if we built one in Orange County, that it would be, you know, state of the art so far as neighborhood impact is concerned. But still, there would be neighborhood impacts if only the trucks going to it. And the other challenge or issue with a local MRF, the government-owned and operated MRF, would be that once you have spent the kind of capital dollars that it takes to create a MRF, then you have debts that you've got to pay back, and that means that the beast, you have to feed the beast. The waste stream has to come to that materials recovery facility. And that means a couple different things. That means that if Orange County was going to do that, that they would be looking to us to make a real commitment to send our waste stream there, that they want to hear that we're going to be one of the customers sending our waste there, number one. But number two, there's the question of whether it begins to put us at odds at some level with our more fundamental, our number one goal or strategy, which is to reduce the volume of our waste. That's a familiar discussion from landfill tip fees and gasoline taxes and other things that we've discussed here. I think there are some very difficult issues for us to grapple with in all of that. But I think the one thing that I've more than anything else been trying to express to the Solid Waste Advisory Board is that, and y'all correct me if I'm wrong, but I think as a community, Carrboro is very much committed to moving forward with the kind of goals that we have set for ourselves in the past, and that we want to see a system that will help to achieve those goals.
Well, the only thing I would say to that is I would agree with that, except I would, notwithstanding, that I don't think we would want to achieve our goals on the back of somebody else. You know, I just can't reiterate that enough. Having watched the extension of the landfill of where it was, that I will fight people to the death. I'm just letting people know now. So everybody should get prepared. But I will. I brought it up, and I was the person that voted against transferring it to the county. And on some levels, I'm glad they have to make the decision, but on some levels, we have to make a decision. And my only other comment is that I hope after we receive the report that we would, as soon as possible, schedule a work session just on this, because these are the kind of things we need to discuss so people can either say, because of A, we will go with this, or because of B, we cannot go with this. I mean, it's just... Because once, like you said, once you make a decision about the MRF, you've got to pay it back, and it's sort of like the thing with the WASA. The more water people use, the greater the revenue stream, but the less water we have to conserve. So, you know.
Well, I wonder if really we need a work session before the report is finished so that our input gets in earlier. And my recollection is that SWAB is not meeting until September.
Maybe tomorrow. Other than tomorrow, but I think that the real issue is that they're going to try and work on the plan over the course of the summer, uh-huh, while they're not being interrupted by SWAB meetings.
Okay.
I'm allowed to say that. They can't say that.
But I can say that. Yeah. But we should think about scheduling a discussion sooner rather than later. Is my point, irrespective of their schedule.
Can I just get some clarity? You all were talking about a discussion about transfer station siting in particular?
About these various issues that have come up tonight and whatever else might come.
Yeah, I don't think so. Not about transfer siting in particular, but although that would be a component of it, because it's, you know, transfer siting, station siting, or MRF siting are both, you know, they're integral to how you develop this plan. Because if the theory is we're not going to have a MRF or a transfer station in Orange County, if that's the theory, that's going to change the plan. That's going to really direct the plan in a very specific direction.
There's a wild card, too, about having facilities elsewhere versus here, and that is transportation costs.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The dynamics of that is sort of changing where, you know, if you have to go every day to a transfer station in Raleigh, over time, you're going to pay for a transfer station locally 10 times over. So it's getting more complicated.
But aren't we committed to paying to haul our waste somewhere? It's just whether it's, you know, goes to a transfer station first and then hauled to a dump, or whether it's separated first and then hauled. And
yeah, in my mind, there's no question that the actual ultimate disposal of the waste will be in some other county. I think the key issue is how will it get there? Will it be from a local transfer station, or will it be from a regional transfer station? And at some point, you're going to get to the point where you need a transfer station to get it to the transfer station if it's too far away.
But presumably, in any case, we'll have full trucks, you know, going to wherever that location is. So.
One last thing I just remembered also. In this National League of Cities conference, there was a guy there, which I think that's what we're doing here, but there's a guy who didn't know there was so much gold on computers, who has a big business just buying and removing for free at no cost to taxpayers all the computer waste And apparently there's a lot of gold in those things that makes it it's a profitable.
There's truly gold.
to take it out.
We have a fairly robust electronics recycling program in Orange County now. It's all voluntary. I will make one pitch to you all. The state is about to consider a bill to put a $5 fee on new computers and televisions, which would finance the electronics recycling statewide that we in our county absorb all the costs for locally now. So that would shift that burden to the purchaser of new computers and TVs. That's Senate Bill 1030. So
who gets that money?
For free. We can get somebody to do that.
We would
free.
Get a portion of money.
We get a portion.
The way we would get, like with the white goods tax, the way the bill is structured now, proportionate to our population, we have access to that money. And in regard to your comment about the free part, we're getting our computer, our CPUs taken at no cost, but then we're paying for monitors and VCRs and all the stuff that really has zero or negative value. So yeah, the value of the precious metals is carrying the weight of the CPU per se, but there's a lot of other electro junk that people are getting rid of. As everybody's switching from VCR to DVD, we're taking the old VCRs and there's very little recoverable there, so it kind of balances out. Well, actually, we end up supporting that program with local funds.
And there is a guy, I mean, this guy will take everything. And like, I'm still puzzled, you know, how they make money on that stuff, but I guess there's other stuff that might be in there that he sells, that he says the gold and the copper that he recovers from that. I can get you the contact information.
So it sounds like we're going to work, Steve, we'll work together to schedule some more time to discuss some of these issues as soon as we can.
I'd just go ahead and say that the work sessions between now and the summer break are full.
Okay.
Mayor Chilton, I would like to make the offer that if you need Blair, myself, or someone else to assist or participate in any way in any work session or discussions you have, just ask.
You're glad to send Blair anytime. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to come and meet with us, and we really appreciate it, and appreciate your sitting through our other agenda items to get to this team.
Thank glad you. The interest level's still high after all these years.
What can we say?
All right.
How about we take the break since we're scheduled?
Yeah, that's a good point. What is the next?
Y'all can take a break.
Let's take a break. We'll take a break.
I just wanted to let you know.
We'll take a 10-minute break.
I'm leaving.
Five-minute break.
I don't care.
I'm leaving it.
Thank you all. The next item on our agenda is item D3, a charter amendment clarifying the filling of board vacancies. We do have a number of citizens who are signed up to speak, so let's have a brief presentation from the staff, and then we'll hear from citizens, and then we'll have a discussion, as may be necessary.
I don't have a heck of a lot to say about this, but I think after the board's meeting in April, Mike Burr was asked to prepare a draft charter amendment to address the midterm appointment issue and how those the appointment and then the election of a potential election of a midterm appointee should be handled. And really, the way the proposed amendment is drafted, it would have to be a charter amendment. The board here would really approve the charter amendment, then it would be presented to the legislature for its consideration in the upcoming session. But the long and the short of it is the way it's drafted is intended really to kind of fill in the gaps of the language of the ordinance based on the language of the statute that authorizes the ordinance in the first place, and to really carry out what we think was the intent of the statute and the ordinance in the first place. And that is in the situation where you have a board member who is a vacancy in the board. There's an election coming up that's more than 90 days after the vacancy is filled. In the midterm election, the fourth highest vote getter would get, because there are three of your board members are up for election during the midterm election anyway, the fourth highest vote getter would get the seat. If there are two seats open, then the fifth highest vote getter would get the second open seat. And really, it's just a way to kind of fill in the gaps of what we think is the intent of the ordinance and the statute anyway.
I would like to ask, when this was originally, we asked for clarification. I was kind of hoping that it could even be more specific, that possibly giving some kind of labeling or titling to the D section and a titling to the E section, so folks, when reading those two sections, would know that E refers to filling vacancies and D refers to the election. In layman's terms and labeled, mm-hmm. I think that would also be helpful.
So it would be like D, conduct of elections,
exactly.
E, filling of vacancies.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or how to fill vacancies.
Right.
How to vary.
Right.
All right.
Even more concrete.
Yeah.
I do, as I say, have a number of people signed up to speak, so I want to. Sure.
When you mean vacant prior to the general election, you're talking about.
What line are you on?
Section D 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 line, under the underlined seats become vacant prior to the general election, so that I understand. If it's within that 90-day period, the fourth person gets it. But if it's the outside the 90-day period, the board appoints.
What happens is if the election is less than 90 days after the vacancy occurs, so the board appoints someone to fill the position, they fill it out for the rest of, until the next election, not just for 90 days.
Right.
But what happens is when the vacancy occurs more than 90 days before the next election,
right?
Okay, then the board can appoint someone to fill the vacancy, but then the, let me make sure I have this right so I'm thinking straight on it.
No, I don't know.
When you have people running for election, the fourth highest vote getter in the election, because you have three seats that are already up in the general election.
Right.
Let's say so your first three highest vote getters are going to get those three seats.
Right.
The fourth highest vote getter would get the fourth seat to fill out, there wouldn't be an appointment when there's more than 90 days left. The fourth highest seat would go to the fourth highest vote getter would go to the person to fill that seat for the remainder of the term. I don't know if I got that right. I'm looking at the language here. I didn't draft it.
So
that's not clarity.
Right. Yeah. And so that would need to go in the title, too, that's to how to fill for a 90 day remainder.
Well,
that sounds like
the 90-day issue. It has to do with this: is that if the let's say that the day before the election, when the incumbent alderman died, well,
say resigned because they got $1 million job.
Okay. For example, then the world would not have been on notice that there was to be a vacancy there under those circumstances.
Okay.
And so the notion is that there's one rule that applies when there's a vacancy that happens early enough before a midterm election that the world's on notice and people can file to run for alderman, and everybody knows going into it that there's a fourth seat or even a fifth seat available.
Right. Okay.
One point I want to clarify is that what this is addressing is not the scenario that happened this past fall.
Right. It does not change the result, does not change what method we would have used for
because we didn't have the vacancy occurring.
Right.
Didn't happen 90 days beforehand.
Exactly.
It happened
exactly.
It actually happened a month after.
But that is addressed in Section A, which is that vacancies are filled by appointment,
but
unless they're more than 90 days.
But that represents no change.
In which case, if they're more than 90 days, then they're filled via the election that occurs, the next general election.
Okay. I understand.
Okay. So we have a number of citizens who are signed up to speak, and we'll start. Bob Kirshner is signed up.
Appreciate it once again, just recognizing me on this. I know this has been a hot topic over the past several months, and I believe I'm bringing somewhat of a fresh perspective to this. As in Carborough, some discussion has been of what kind of representation or democracy are we here, and I want to bring up that we are a representative democracy in Carborough, whereby, you know, during this past election, the six board members were elected by the citizens of Carborough to conduct town business on the town citizens' behalf. In the dictionary, representative democracy is a form of democracy founded to the exercise of popular sovereignty by the people's representatives. It is a theory of civics in which voters choose in a free, secret, multi-party election representatives to act in their interest, but not necessarily as their proxies, which means not necessarily according to the voters' wishes, but with enough authority to exercise an initiative to face the changing circumstances. Now, before you get all excited on that, this does mean, as I've argued with you before, you do have some incumbents of duties with that, such as fiduciary duties to do the appropriate things. However, with that said, in this past election, as we all know, the vacancy came up after the election, which was not in that 90-day period. The board does need to be able to select. You do have a selection process to fill a vacancy for a number of emergency situations, such as you won the lottery and you got $1 million, you're moving on. a hurricane situation where, heaven forbid, something happened to one of you, or a nuclear terror event where half of you might be wiped out, and heaven forbid, Mark might need to grab the next person standing next to him and immediately anoint him.
That's interesting.
So the needing the level of having a, you know, being able to have a selection process is important, but I want to suggest to you an opinion, my opinion on this, to help in what occurred in the last election here. For clarity's sake, if you, and as our representative, you have put a comment of time to consider this point, it would be helpful, I believe, if a provision was added to the charter there that in the case of, if the vacancy was to occur or is in anticipated to incur as a direct result of an election, that the position be filled by the additional voting, which would be prior notice. You would know that the possibility within 90 days, because when all the candidates filed, it would be plenty of time for all the citizens to be made aware that a vacancy or the potential of the vacancy would be occurring. And they therefore would be able to make appropriate choices during the election process. So that's what I wanted to add, that particular provision. The other than the draft that I saw there looked very good. I think the importance of the 90 days was there's a process involved with trying to add people to an election in an actual election, whether it's the midterm or a general election. You know, there are things that need to take place just with the election board and the ballots and advertising and announcements. So I think 90 days is a reasonable period to say, you know, prior to that, 90 days is a good period. Prior to 90 days, you have plenty of time to do the work that needs to be done. Within 90 days is too short of a period to accurately communicate. However, just to summarize real quick, in the case of it's going to open up because of as a direct result of the election, such as in this past case, then it'd be probably helpful to you as well as the citizen to just better be clear that we're going to go to the next available person, right, that was elected. And I hope that's – thank you very much.
Thank you. Katrina Ryan.
I actually
have
Glennis to go before me, and I'm
happy to be
first.
Okay. Glennis, go to be first. Second.
Hello. My name is Glennis Gore. I live in Carborough, and I've lived here for 11 years now. And I was a past chair of the Environmental Advisory Board, served on that board for many years. And I'm here tonight to express some disappointment with the opportunity our town had and still has to show leadership in democracy. As the previous speaker indicated, what happened in the last election was actually something that was known in advance and gave all of us an opportunity to make a difference in how democracy is expressed. We didn't take that opportunity. Instead, we engaged in what I hate to refer to but must refer to as a selective process of choosing one's own playmates rather than choosing who the people thought would be the next best representative to fill the spot that everyone knew would be vacant because two people from the board were running for mayor. So it's with a heavy heart that I come to address the board because I not only expect better of the town that I live in and the town that I've worked very hard to support, but I think I speak for a number of people who are not here tonight on that same issue. I believe that it is possible going forward to correct that type of thinking and put in place a process that recognizes that we don't play the same kinds of games that are played in Washington, where you get to pick and choose your playmates and make sure that everybody on the board thinks like you do. Instead, that you really do reach out and live the motto of diversity and embracing diversity. We've done a pretty good job so far. We had an opportunity to expand that, and we stepped away from it. And I ask that in the future we do not do that again. Thank you.
And the last person I have signed up is Katrina Ryan.
I've been told by my 20-year-old stepdaughter that I perhaps take elections a little too seriously. I've worked at every election day from 5:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night since I was 13 years old. So getting to people to participate in elections and do their civic duty is extraordinarily important to me. And it's very, very hard to get this 20-year-old and the kids in my neighborhood to vote, to care, to do things when there's a real distinct possibility that your vote doesn't count. and one of the most engaged, intelligent communities I've ever been the privilege to be a part of, and that's Carrboro. Less than 6% of the total population voted yesterday. 13.2% of those who are registered, and there's only 60% of adults in town who bother to even register, let alone show up and vote. And for those of us who show up and spend 14 hours on election day and countless hours contributing to the democratic process, I have to ask before you vote, how can you possibly justify in the spirit of the democratic process that an appointment by anybody is better than an election by everybody? I don't understand, as a big D and a small D Democrat. You guys have the power here tonight to call for a pick four election, which is when it should, in legal terminology, you know, should be known in the future that there'll be a fourth vacancy because you have two aldermen running for mayor. You pick four, fourth place vote getter goes. You have the power to ask the General Assembly to hold a special election, and you could do it concurrently with the primaries. You could do an interim appointment, and then there's months' notice that here's a vacancy. And yet, at least what I saw in the last session was that the inclination is to continue to choose rather than allow people to elect. And that, to me, seems absolutely contradictory to everything this country and this town is about. And I think we can do better.
Thanks. There was one more gentleman who wanted to speak.
You hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. My name is Rick Tanner. I'm a citizen of Carrboro, lived here for 11 years. I used to be on the Board of Adjustment, and so I've sat on your side of the table for many issues. If there is one issue that is tantamount to everything that our city does, it is democracy. We are accountable to the people. The three most important words of our Constitution are, we, the people. You are accountable to the people. Appointing someone that's not accountable to the voters is not democracy. Political appointments are often about patronage. They're not about democracy. So as a citizen, I mean, you are accountable to us. That's why we have elections. But we have elections to vote everyone, not some of them. So with that, I urge you to vote for democracy.
Thanks, Rick.
Sure.
Thanks. Alderman, if there's if there's a new direction for us to go, if there's room for there to be a new direction for us to go, then let's discuss this. Then let's spend the time we need to spend on it. But we've all had some discussion before, so I want to hear about changed minds or not.
I guess I just want to follow up on Randy's suggestion about having headings on these sections, which I think everyone nodded was a good one, but I assume that needs to go back to the attorney and come back to us again
in final form. Do you have suggestions? I mean, I want to make sure I have it close as possible.
Actually, the deadline for local bills is in about a week and a half.
May 17th.
Okay, so we need to craft that
a week and two-thirds.
Tonight.
Right. So, 2 weeks. So, we need to either plug in some proposed headings there
for D, how to fill election vacancies, and for E, how to fill vacancies. Wait a minute. I'm trying to read my notes. I've got to scroll.
I think I said D is, suggested D is conduct of elections, and E is filling of vacancies.
Filling of vacancies. Okay.
That's pretty clear.
Yeah. And
Alex,
those two sections would be titled. Everything else is we're comfortable with.
thanks, Mark. And without belaboring the point, I'm not going to go on at length. I think I'd explain where I was coming from last week, but I just need to reiterate that in substance, I can't support what we have before us. I believed then and believe now, and since when we asked the question of the attorney, he indicated that he could draft a charter amendment which would create an automatic process which would require that the vacancy created as a direct result of an election could be that an amendment could be drafted that would require that be filled by the next highest vote getter for a variety of reasons, many that I outlined last week. Some of what was said just now I agree with, some of which I don't, in terms of how the process went forward. It was that the process is governed by the charter that we have before us, so I think we did as well as we could given what we had. However, we did end up with what was, for lack of a better term, a second campaign where the attention of this board and of the public was not focused on how the town moved forward, but was instead focused on politics, on jockeying and lobbying and who is going to get what. And, you know, that's just a natural outgrowth. Again, it's nobody's fault. That's just a natural outgrowth of the process that we were working under. I believe that the solution, again, would be, the proper solution would be to create and put into place an automatic mechanism which would account for the situation that occurred and address it directly so that future boards wouldn't have to go through that and that the community wouldn't have to go through that. And so I think everybody around this table is really trying to work in good faith and has throughout the process. But I will, unfortunately, unless I can convince people otherwise, and last time I ran this up the flagpole, it didn't get very far. So I unfortunately, without that substantive change, cannot support the amendment as proposed.
Jackie.
What would you suggest instead, in very succinct, clear to understand words?
I guess I didn't mean to be obscure. I was trying to be as direct as I could. I would suggest that, again, a mechanism be drafted that would, by whichever mechanism, either by fourth place on the ballot when it is known that a vacancy is going to be created by as a direct result of an upcoming election, that be a fourth place on the ballot, in essence a pick four. Another way of doing it theoretically, I don't know if it's possible, might be a provisional fourth place, in which case if it were A or B, let's say somebody from the board ran for that slot and somebody not from the board ran for that slot, but the somebody from the board ran and won.
You're losing me.
Well, I can't make it any simpler than this.
Well,
Marxies.
Well, I think I do. I mean, or what occurs to me is, I guess you could have a voting system in which basically you mark the ballot. I'm voting for these are my three favorite candidates that I'm voting for, and if there should be a vacancy any time in the next 2 years, then this is the person on this ballot who I want to go in that vacancy.
Not.
Well, you say that's simple, but who comes in fourth in a pick three race? This is where I have to differ with this point. Who comes in fourth in a pick three race is the person who is a person who has been rejected by the voters.
Right.
Well, in any case, that's just one mechanism. What I'm saying is, in substance, I mean, if it were agreed by the board that we wanted to change the substance of what we were doing to a charter amendment, which would then create an automatic mechanism which would place it in the hands of the voters, either through a provisional ballot or some charter amendment which would then compel the board, for example, to appoint the next highest vote getter in the previous election. You may not agree with that, but...
Well, something like that.
But something like that.
Yeah, I couldn't go with the next highest... I could go with a change, but I cannot go with the next highest vote getter for the reasons Mark's outlined.
Mark.
Please let us talk about it.
John's actually next, and then Dan, Joel.
I mean, I think we're beating the dead corp here. What part of this we don't understand? I mean, this is Scarborough, small town. This is not the... I mean, we can get all the semantics about democracy, and I think the... number one, to me, is an issue. I mean, we have the issue of the tyranny of the minority, which people with money can move into the town and try to impose and change and influence a political system. Or, you know, we can play the game of democracy, which we're spreading throughout the world. And we know that this country has a reputation of doing that. You can finance it, and you can do it. You know, you got the money and the weapons, you can do any democracy you want, in any style. I think 2 years for a small board like this, you know, this is not the General Assembly of North Carolina. This is a seven-body board member. To appoint somebody, the law is very clear. I mean, I think the democracy that has been working in North Carolina and the folks who have been drafting all these laws, they just didn't come out with this overnight. The system has been working fine. Democracy doesn't supposed to be easy or cookie cutter and say, okay, that's it. You know, this is how we deal with it. You know, let's have a manual. It's like life. You know, it comes without a manual. I think it's a fair process. There are some discrepancies about putting on the board somebody who was rejected by the voters also. And the thing is, it's a 2-year appointment. This is not a, you know, dictatorial, tyrannical, you know, decision where we ignore the power of the people and for the next 4 years this person will be appointed by the wish of the board. No, it's temporary, it's 2 years. There are some towns maybe with bigger budgets who can afford to, and rich people can afford always to run any kind of elections they have. I think it doesn't rise to the need of an overhaul of the system. I think there are other systems in our democracy that are not working for everybody. But I'm happy with the way the law is, and if it's not broken, don't fix it. I think we deal in the past with these issues. We can continue to deal with this issue, with these clarifications. I think, especially with what happened now, voters will be better informed and be aware of these issues. And I think in 2 years we'll be seeing folks in this board participating. You know, we just franchise a whole bunch of disenfranchised voters in Northern Carboro, and we're doing everything we can to enhance their participation and include them in everything we can. So, 2 years, and it's a good time to have a transition for the community to get fully involved, you know, in the democratic process. But I think the law is clear as it is.
Yeah, I think.
Not that I'm going to be long-winded, but I think Dan would.
Right, and let me just point out that this is, you know, I guess the point I was trying to make earlier is, if there's a discussion we can have that's going to lean toward minds changing, then let's have that discussion. And if not, then let's move on.
Yeah, I guess my point is I'm not averse to discussing this, and, you know, I think there are certainly a variety of solutions that meet different criteria of what is democratic, but I don't think we're going to come to an agreement on this aspect of it before the deadline for this legislative session. I also think that citizens who were following this process, with the exception of the four who were somehow here tonight to speak to this, would have expected that at our last discussion that we rejected any further discussion, as Alex alluded to, and that we were just going to talk about the clarification tonight. So there may be citizens who aren't here. So I agree with Jackie's effort to call the question, and I'm not opposed to talking about this again in the fall.
Joel?
You know, I'm sort of saying that we probably need to talk about it more. Because I really don't think... You know, we sort of almost need to take it out of the context of how it arose. And whether...
Speaking to your mic.
Oh, okay. I thought my, you know, former cheerleader thought I was loud enough. You know, sort of in the context it arose.
Yeah.
That had there been different circumstances, we may not be having this conversation. And the level of emotion that is surrounding this conversation, it would be absent. And so if it's just to clarify, that's fine, but I think we need to, and I know some people are opposed to it, but I think we really need to revisit it again.
In the fall?
Mm-hmm.
We have two weeks to get a local bill introduced in this session, but let me point out that we have a whole nother year and a half or a whole nother legislative session beyond this one before the next election, local election cycle happens. That is to say,
you have a long session next year.
You have a long session next year, and you know we could come up with another solution then. But let's vote on this matter, and
I'd like to make a motion that we adopt this, and include it in the motion that in August or September we revisit this. So we adopt it as presented with Randy's changes, and that we will put it on our agenda in the fall for a further discussion and crafting.
Is there a second for that motion?
I'll second that. Was there not a motion, or was it not already a motion on the floor?
There was not. So that's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Nay.
The matter passes 4-3. Joel Brown, Mark Chilton, and Alex Zaffron voting no. All right. On our next.
Wait a minute.
I just want to make sure I understand what it is we're to do with this, because the resolution in the packet says this would go to the delegation for consideration in the.
And it
short
does.
Right. I think that's what we're doing. Okay.
That's the motion to carry.
Okay. I just want to make
and
sure.
And it also says that we will put it on the agenda for the fall to
look at this issue.
To look at the issue and come up with a solution.
Okay, so you're asking for a charter amendment in the short session and then come right back and revisit it.
Yeah,
August.
We are.
I just want to make sure
potentially.
I understood that.
Potentially.
Okay.
Potentially, yeah.
Do we need a presentation on the next two items? Otherwise, I would move 4 and 5.
Mr. Manager, we don't need a presentation, but the only reason this is not on the consent agenda, if you look at the resolution, these automatically go to the Planning Commission, the Planning Board, and Orange County. There's a checklist as a part of the resolution to ask you all if you want these items to be referred to any of the other advisory boards or commissions.
Oh, we went from 30 seconds to 30 minutes.
No, we didn't. Right. I can do a minute.
Well, you're not the only one. Joel, go ahead.
I would just say that I would take off the Northern Transition Area Advisory Committee unless it's in or near that area, because we just had difficulty. Mm-hmm. There are only 672 people that are eligible, I guess, now for the seat.
Well, we're on this appearance commission issue first.
That's
the okay,
one.
But it's the same.
Right.
It's the same set of.
Wow.
Right. I mean, that's just my
boards
opinion.
To potentially report to.
I support it being sent to the other boards for item number 5, but I do not for item number 4. Item number 4 is simply reiterating and making clear.
I take
clear.
That as a motion.
I'm amending my motion to remove 5 and move 4 as it stands.
With none of those boxes checked.
None of those boxes checked.
None of the boxes checked. Okay, I'll second that.
All right, so that's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Matter passed unanimously. We're on to item 5. Alex, would you like to make a motion?
Yeah, I'll move number 5, and I would suggest that under number 5, the salient boards would be Appearance, EAB, Economic Sustainability Commission, and Northern Transitionary Advisory Committee.
Second.
Okay. So that's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed.
Matter passed unanimously.
No.
All those opposed. All those opposed. Oh. One. Excuse me. Joel is opposed. matter passes 6-1. I would like. I work for one of the organizations that's having money indirectly. Work for one of the organizations that's having money allocated under the home program budget. So I would like to ask the board to recuse me from voting on item 6 on the agenda.
Is sorry. There a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, it passes unanimously. On to item number 6.
Okay. Item 6 is the recommended home program funding plan for budget year 2006-2007 and approval of the consolidated plan. Purpose of this item is for the proposed plan to be considered by the board as developed by the Home Program Review Committee for the use of home program funds for fiscal year 2006-2007. James Harris.
In the year 2000, in the year 1992, the home program was established between the town of Chapel Hill, Carborough, Orange County, and Hillsborough. It was established so that we could receive entitlement funds to help the towns and the local and county government provide for affordable housing in our county. This year, we've been notified that we've received an award of $665,000. Let me go back one second. We also have a steering committee, and I want to just recognize Alvin Coleman for presenting on that, working on that committee. He also led the first discussion for this, though. And that was his first meeting, so that was a good meeting. There is a match requirement for this money. Carver's match requirement is $20,965. And in your agenda packet, I've listed the matches from the other governments. The total match for all of them would be $149,750. That would be added to the $665,000 for allocation this year. In addition to that, we're reprogramming some program income in the amount of $135,272, which can also be spent in this year, for a total of $950,583. In your packet, you'll see listed the projects that are being considered for this year, and it will require your approval along with the approval of the other local governments so that we can submit this proposal to HUD as a plan for expenditure. We also need to amend our consolidated plan, which included last year's spending plan, and substitute this year's spending plan in that document. That document will be submitted to HUD on May the 15th. So my request is that you approve the resolution that's in your packet.
The item?
Second.
Okay, there's a motion by Alderman Zaffron, a second by either Herrera or Coleman from that end. Is there any discussion? There being none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, it passes unanimously.
Thank Dan for his work.
Thanks, Dan.
Good work. And James.
Matters by the town clerk. Matters by the town manager.
No, ma'am.
Matters by the town attorney.
None that I've been advised of.
Matters by board members. Dan.
Yeah, I have two items. One is I'm interested in knowing if we can get some kind of a quick report after our meetings on significant actions of the board that might come out, perhaps the Wednesday morning after, like I'm thinking a one-page document. Chapel Hill does that, and it works very well. And this came up for me because it was actually Wes Hare and people connected with his group were surprised to learn this week that we had passed the impeachment resolution that Jackie brought to us on March 14th, and it wasn't in two of the local papers because Mei Ling was away that night. And, you know, so, you know, something that both for the press and also for people on our listserv would give them a quick summary of what we do. I think that would be very helpful for the community and just for us to be communicating with people. So, yeah.
We need to talk about that. I will say that Chapel Hill has a full-time public information officer who does that, and we don't have anybody like that. So, you know, we'll look at it, but we're not staffed the way Chapel Hill is.
Okay.
I'd like to suggest that that would be an excellent opportunity for an intern from the journalism department, or I mean, you could only have them maybe for 6 or 8 months, but I think that would be a good internship if we can't find a staff person to do it.
And I'm not saying we can't. I just, we spend a lot of time with agenda follow-ups and preparing agendas for a very small staff with meetings every week, and there are only so many people.
Go in the back room and clone some.
So,
whatever you can come up with,
okay.
Let us know. The other item I had is to do with the, we all got an email from the Chamber of Commerce about a trip they're planning to Madison, Wisconsin in the fall, and that I think they're interested, possibly some of us and some staff participating, and I have, I guess, 4 concerns about that, sort of in priority order. One is that we're the board that would not send ourselves or our staff to Chapel Hill for a meeting on a weekday that, you know, our citizens could not attend. And so it hardly seems to me that we ought to be going all the way to Madison. One thing about this meeting is that it's not, you know, it's not connected to any public purpose that we've identified. You know, I would contrast it with trips like, for example, I don't know if any of our board was on that, but some of our local officials in the county, you know, went to visit MRFs, for example, to look at how those facilities go that were for an identified public purpose, or the elected officials across the triangle who went to Ottawa to look at their transportation system. So there's that, the fact that it's, you know, it's a, you know, it's a meeting that's out of the public eye and that is not accessible to our citizens. So that is the first point. Second point, I might actually forget all 4 of my points, but there is an issue to do with it being on Rosh Hashanah, which is, it's the second day, but it is a 2-day holiday for many people, and, you know, perhaps they could change it, and I think, you know, the paramount concern is the one about going out of town for this kind of meeting that I don't think we should do, but it is on Rosh Hashanah, and I don't think we should participate in a meeting on a high holiday for, you know, a major religious group in the community. And then the third point is the cost, which is $13.45, they're estimating, per person, or $4.65 if you go on a scholarship. And, you know, that's a lot of money for what's basically a day and a half in Madison for, you know, a fairly vague agenda that is not necessarily connected to our work. And let me just say that, you know, I have no problem with the Chamber organizing this trip for its membership and for members of the community, and I think I would welcome a report from the Chamber to our body that we all could take advantage of subsequently. But I have a real problem with us sending people to do that. And I don't know if that's something we need to talk about tonight or at some other time. But, you know, I would be opposed to our expending funds, certainly, for that purpose.
You know, I think it's probably an issue that bears more thought and a little more advanced thought than maybe we're necessarily prepared to give it tonight. But I do think it's important if the board feels as a whole or as a majority that way for that to come out, because I think there is very much the intention that our town manager and the mayor to That is what the group wants, is for the town manager and the mayor, at the very least, to go on this trip. And if that's – I don't work for y'all, but not, or at least not the way Steve Stewart does, but I think if the board feels that he should not go, that we need to, you know,
I don't think we should have a 10:05 discussion about it right now.
That's right. My first point about it.
All right. Can we schedule it in a time sufficient enough for us to discuss it?
I think it's not until September, so I assume they're not needed.
I agree with Dan's points, so I'll look forward to the discussion.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I want a background. I'm not going to stake out a position now until I get all the information.
I can always change mine. I wanted to ask that if the legislative items that we prepared for the breakfast, if that list was going to be on the website so that the general public would know the kinds of...
Okay. Yeah. I just want to thank all the citizens of Carrboro and everywhere around this country who supported... sending a message to our elected officials that we really need comprehensive immigration reform. I was very proud also to see business and individuals, who, especially local businesses, who close and did that in a symbolic way, not to hurt anybody, but just to raise the point that immigrants are not invisible, you know, to our community and to our lives every day. Although politically and legally they are invisible. And they're not aliens, they're real human beings, and they live among us. And I think that I just want to thank all the leadership that came out of this town and all over North Carolina and all over this country, that I think the message got across, and that this country needs to legalize the illegal immigration policy that makes you, the employers, and the workers, you know, do illegal things. Thank you.
Quick. Can we get Chapel Hill to... I was late, so this may have already been discussed.
It hasn't been discussed.
Chip in for our $15,000 cost.
My plan was to have an informal conversation with the manager and then to proceed from there.
Okay.
Sorry.
You're not going to just send him an invoice, huh?
No.
We talk
why not? No, just a letter. A pleasant letter.
Like see how that goes.
Envelope.
Like a collection agent.
I wanted to add to what John Herrera was saying, just by noting two things. One, that there was a lot of activity there were two different marches on last Monday that neither of which were permits filed for or issued for.
Were they insured?
They definitely weren't insured. And there was a very significant rally that also, you know, happened in a very impromptu way, and I just wanted to compliment our staff on having handled those situations very sensitively and accommodated the situation. Thank you to the Police Department, the Parks and Rec Department, and I'm sure the Public Works Department, among others, for your handling of that. And also, I want to just brag on our fellow alderman that he was down in Lumberton, North Carolina, to speak on Monday for a similar rally in Lumberton, where there was a crowd assembled of 10,000 people participating in the event. And then the final thing, just very briefly, we're going to have community input sessions for the development of Carrboro's economic development plan for the future, and there'll be two workshops that the public is very much invited to come to. The first one will be Saturday, May 20th. That's 2 weeks from this Saturday, from 10 to noon at the Homestead Community Center. And the second will be the Wednesday after that, which is, say, 3 weeks from today, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Carrboro Elementary School. We would very much invite you all to come and participate and help us develop a vision for Carrboro's economic development in the future. And then finally, Carrboro Day is
Sunday.
This Sunday. And so there'll be all sorts of events happening in connection with that over here at Weaver Street, between Weaver Street Market and Carrboro Town Hall.
And along the Bowling Corridor.
Oh, and along Bowling Creek Corridor, there'll be a walk and a number of other things.
Several hikes.
I think there's quite a bit of information at Carrboro.com.
That's right.
About that.
Volunteers are needed still, right?
And volunteers are still needed, actually, yes. And you can volunteer through Carrboro.com. Thanks very much, y'all.
Gavel.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor of adjournment, walk out.